And on Friday, we speak to Mansoura Daifi, who was imprisoned at Guantanamo for more than a decade. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
Did you know that KBOO is streaming live on the web? Well, you do now. Just type www.kboo.fm, click on Listen Live, and you've got us. Just another example of how KBOO 90.7 FM Portland works for you. It's your community radio.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, three men convicted for the murder of Ahmaud Arbery, American Indians commemorate National Day of Mourning, and in international news, Sweden's first female prime minister resigns hours after election. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, November 24th, 2021. I'm Ethan Sandweiss. Three men have been convicted in the murder of Georgia man Ahmaud Arbery. Arbery was chased, cornered, and shot by father and son Gregory and Travis McMichael and their neighbor William Bryan Jr. in February 2020. The McMichaels said they suspected Arbery of theft when they saw him jogging in their neighborhood. The case highlighted the inequalities in the American judicial system. Law enforcement failed for months to investigate Arbery's killing or make arrests. The district attorney also specifically prohibited officers from arresting Greg McMichael, who was a former colleague of hers. Arrests were made after widespread protests. The defense team also raised issues during the trial by asking the judge to remove black pastors from the courtroom and striking down black jurors. In the end, Brian and the McMichaels were convicted by a jury of 11 white and one black member. The new congressional maps that state Democrats drew passed the muster of a five-judge panel, despite Republican pushback. After the 2020 census, Oregon's population grew enough to earn a sixth congressional seat, making the district redrawing process even more contentious than usual. The plans did not receive a single Republican vote, and members walked out over maps they said unfairly favored Democrats. The new map creates four safe seats for Democrats, one safe seat for Republicans, and one seat that could be a toss-up. Republicans challenged the map, but a five-judge panel rejected their arguments that the maps were unfair. Political gerrymandering, or improperly manipulating political maps to favor one party, is difficult to prove in court. Earlier this week, a judge also rejected the Republican challenge to the new state house and Senate district maps. The five-judge panel in the congressional map case said they would only consider invalidating the maps if the redistricting commission didn't consider what they were required to by law. That would include having an equal population between districts, keeping communities of interest whole, and making sure that districts are connected by political or geographic features. Republicans, including former Secretary of State Clarno, are reportedly considering a further challenge to the maps before the Oregon Supreme Court. Maps will no longer be required in crowded outdoor settings. That's according to an update from the Oregon Health Authority on Tuesday. They are still required indoors, and elderly, immunocompromised, or high-risk folks are still encouraged to wear them when outside. The change reflects progress in Oregon's coronavirus fight, which saw a major surge in cases from the Delta variant in August and September. Case numbers are now down 64%, but hospitalizations remain high. This comes just after the OHA announced that Oregon had surpassed 5,000 official coronavirus deaths on Monday. Patrick Allen is the director of the Oregon Health Authority. He said in a statement that the decision is, quote, a testament to the perseverance of all Oregonians in adopting the public health interventions that we know are effective in containing the spread of the disease. Together, we have managed to turn back a tsunami of new infections that very nearly swamped our healthcare system, end quote. Oregon has the fourth lowest case rate in the nation and the sixth lowest rate of death. Quarantine at Oregon schools is expected to be alleviated some with a newly adopted stay-to-test rule. The goal of the test to stay is to keep the students in class by allowing kids to stay in class once they've tested negative for COVID twice. Students who've been exposed will take a test soon after exposure, usually at school, and another 5 to 7 days later. The tests are free, don't require insurance or disclosure of immigration status. The schools will use rapid antigen tests to determine if students are infected, but there are some stipulations. It's intended to address unvaccinated students, which in Oregon is about 40% of 12 to 17-year-olds and 80% of 5 to 11-year-olds. During that testing period, students need to be quarantined at home and wearing a mask in public settings. And it's only really supposed to be used in school or extracurricular exposures, not from at-home or community exposure. The supply chain and availability was a challenge of implementing the test-to-stay option earlier. Officials say that if tests become more scarce, they may have to pause the rule. Christine Drazin, Republican minority leader in the Oregon State House, is planning to run for governor. As minority leader, Drazin was part of the walkout of legislators who shut down the House by denying a quorum. Drazin said, quote, when it comes to standing up for Oregonians against powerful special interests and entrenched politicians in Salem, I've never backed down from a fight. And now I am ready to fight for the future of Oregon. Of the several announced Republicans running for governor, only Drazin works in state government. Democratic State Representatives Betsy Johnson from Warrenton, who will be running as an unaffiliated candidate, is expected to draw votes from candidates of both parties. Among the Democrats who will be running for governor are House Speaker Tina Kotek, State Treasurer Tobias Reed, and former New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof. The last time a Republican was elected Oregon governor was Vi Atia in 1982. Western monarch butterflies were on the verge of extinction last year, with only 2,000 counted in California. This year, that number is up to 100,000, still only 10% of 1980 levels. With more on this story, here's Suzanne Potter.
The Western monarch butterfly appears to be pulling back from the edge of extinction, with more than 100,000 counted so far in the 25th annual Western Monarch Thanksgiving count. This week, more than 100 butterfly enthusiasts are creeping around groves early each morning, counting the iconic orange and black Western monarch. And they're finding large clusters from Los Angeles to Santa Cruz. Emma Pelton with the Xerces Society says it's unclear if the rebound is due to natural variability or something else.
They move and migrate over such large areas that it's hard to know exactly what weather conditions or environmental factors affected things in any one spot. But we think this is a good example of resiliency.
People who spot a large cluster of monarchs are encouraged to report it on the app iNaturalist so scientists can go check it out. Gardeners also can help the species by reducing pesticide use and by planting the butterfly's favorite flowering bushes, such as native narrowleaf milkweed and other flowers that bloom year-round. While it's good news that the numbers are up, Pelton cautions they are still dangerously low, representing more than a 90% drop from the number of monarchs that overwintered in California in the 1980s.
We would really like to see 500,000 butterflies. We'd like to see 1 million butterflies, which is more of the historic size that we saw in the 90s, not that long ago.
The Biden administration's new infrastructure bill, passed last week, dedicates $10 million over 5 years for projects to benefit monarchs by planting native flowers, adopting pollinator-friendly land management practices, and removing non-native vegetation. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Sweden's first female prime minister was elected today and resigned several hours later. Magdalena Anderson announced her decision to resign on Twitter before her inauguration. Anderson says she hopes to lead Sweden at the head of a single-party social democrat government. Anderson's current coalition consists of Greens, Communists, and her own center-left social democrats. Apparently, members of the coalition voted for a budget bill proposed by opposition parties. Now that the ruling coalition has begun to fracture, Sweden's future government is uncertain. The Biden administration is tapping into federal oil reserves to try and mitigate rising gas prices. With more on the story, it's Mary Sherman with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We and this administration are leaving no stone unturned as we examine the market to figure out what's behind the high prices.
Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm says the Biden administration will tap into the nation's strategic petroleum reserves to cut gasoline prices ahead of the holidays, which are averaging $3.40 a gallon across the country. Prior to his departure for Nantucket Island Tuesday night, where he will spend the holiday with family, President Joe Biden had a message for Americans.
As you gather together with your family this Thanksgiving, I want you to know how grateful I am to serve as your president. And I promised you that I'll never stop working to address your family's needs. And together, we're going to confront challenges that we face them, are going to face them honestly.
15 Republican governors, including Tennessee Governor Bill Lee, announced a plan to address the supply chain crisis. They're pledging state-level action to assist the trucking industry and calling on the White House to loosen regulations.
That will allow for trucks to be on the road longer, to have different weight restrictions on them. We're calling for the federal government to lower the age requirements for CDLs.
The governors also called on Biden to suspend the federal mandate for COVID-19 vaccines for all private employees. But the administration on Tuesday asked a federal court to lift an order halting the mandate, arguing that delaying the standard could result in large numbers of hospitalizations and other health effects outside of the workplace. The Senate will take up the House-passed Build Back Better plan next week, which includes paid family and medical leave, child care, and the elder care workforce. Sequoia is a mom from Jackson, Mississippi, who says additional measures in the bill, such as expanding the child tax credit for another year, would make a big difference for families.
I was actually doing CNA work, but COVID came along and they kind of knocked me out of work. So what do you do when you still have bills, rent, and everything child to provide for? What do you do?
Paid leave could be cut out of the bill when the Senate begins its negotiations next week. A jury has begun deliberations in the trial of three men charged with killing 25-year-old Ahmaud Arbery last February in Georgia. Travis McMichael, his father George McMichael, and William Bryan each faced 9 charges in the case, including murder. Attorneys for the three say that they were attempting a citizen's arrest of Arbery, who they believed was engaged in criminal activity. Lead prosecutor Linda Dunikowski argues that the men had no right to do so, since they had no idea whether Arbery actually committed a crime.
What did Mr. Arbery do? He ran away for 5 minutes. He ran away from them. He ran away from them for 5 minutes. That's what he did.
White nationalist leaders who organized 2017's violent Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, must pay more than $25 million in damages. A jury also found the defendants liable on 4 other counts. Lily Bolke contributed reporting. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael knows gratitude is a great attitude.
I am thankful that I can avoid news and social media for a few days and not have the world crashing through my door. I am thankful that Trump's presidency seems so long ago, though it's been less than a year. A friend asked me, with the riots, the homeless, the lack of police and jobs, if I thought Portland was over. Over what? I asked back. I am thankful to be in Portland, as I wonder what powers want to teach us a lesson for speaking up, for challenging how the wealthy, who mostly don't live here, control everything. The people of Portland are strong, generous, and creative, but the civic machinery is clogged and poorly maintained. Some people are leaving town. Thanks to those who stay, who resil and flex, we don't need headlines. We survived the fires, the freeze, and the heat dome. Whatever comes next, we'll make it through. One day, one step, one hello at a time. The fog's real thick this morning, but the sun will eventually show up. Every day has stretches where each breath is a thank you. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the importance of sustainable fisheries by Stevie Ray. Tonight's weather will be in the 40s with a slight chance of rain. Tomorrow's high is in the 50s. Some rain and wind is expected. Today marks the 5-year anniversary of a peace deal between the government of Colombia and the guerrilla army FARC. The deal ended Colombia's 50-year civil war. The quote of the day is from Shakira. People are not depressed in Colombia the same way they are in America. Off from school and alcohol more available, teens are more likely to make risky choices during the holidays. One Ohio group is advising parents on how to talk with their kids about making good decisions about drugs and alcohol. Here's Mary Sherman with more.
The holiday season has officially started, and one group is encouraging Ohio parents to make a special effort to check in with their teens to help them avoid risky behaviors. With days off school, parties, and distracted parents, experts say underage drinking tends to increase during the holidays. President and CEO of Students Against Destructive Decisions, or SAD, Rick Burt, says alcohol is the most widely used substance among teens, with 14 the average age for a first drink. He encourages parents to set ground rules to manage expectations and to not make discussions about risky behaviors such as one and done.
We've talked with parents all across Ohio who try to have a regular routine check-in, maybe even when you're driving them to the bus stop. Go beyond the how-school conversation, dig into the how are you feeling. The more that you talk with your young person, the more they will have that ongoing conversation with you.
And because risk-taking is a typical part of teenage development, Burt recommends avoiding scare tactics. He says the best conversations focus on education about healthy choices and how to make smart decisions in the face of peer pressure. Other important topics to touch on, Burt adds, include the illegal use of prescription medications, tobacco, and marijuana. And with medical marijuana legal in Ohio, as well as efforts to legalize recreational use, Burt says teens may have misconceptions about its dangers.
The marijuana of today is not the marijuana from the 60s and 70s. It's been genetically modified and is much stronger. It is different depending on how it's ingested, whether it's smoked or used as a dab or used in an edible or in some other way.
Burt also notes it's important to keep a check on a teenager's mood.
While the holidays are full of lights and glamour and special moments, and while we're all oftentimes more together during the holidays, we don't always feel that way. They can be lonely seasons for many young people. There's anxiety and all sorts of other things that come into play.
Parents who are concerned about a teen's mental health can contact their primary care physician. Online resources are available, too, at NAMI.org, OhioSAD.org, and PreventionActionAlliance.org. For Ohio News Connection, I'm Mary Sherman. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Indigenous people in Massachusetts gather at Plymouth tomorrow for the National Day of Mourning, commemorating the anniversary of the massacre preceding the first Thanksgiving meal. With more on the story, here's Lily Bolke.
While many non-Native Americans sit down with their friends or families for a holiday meal tomorrow, some Indigenous communities in Massachusetts will gather in Plymouth, not for Thanksgiving, but for what they call the National Day of Mourning. Since 1970, Indigenous residents have protested on this day as a reminder of the genocide of millions of Native people, the theft of Native lands, and erasure of Native cultures. Matawi Monroe, a co-leader with United American Indians of New England, says it's a protest against racism and oppression that Indigenous people still face.
In particular, on National Day of Mourning, through our work, we've been popping a hole in the bubble that is the national myth about the pilgrims, the Thanksgiving myth.
Monroe adds, in American school lessons, pilgrims and the first Thanksgiving meal are glorified. But she says this obscures the truth of what happened, and that according to Native historians, the first proclaimed Day of Thanksgiving actually followed the massacre of up to 700 Pequot men, women, and children in what is now Connecticut. According to the most recent census survey, more than 90,000 Native American and Alaska Native people live in the Commonwealth. Monroe adds, even more Indigenous people from Mayan and Andean cultures are often categorized as Hispanic or Latino. She says there are many more Indigenous residents of Massachusetts than non-natives realize who have to combat persistent stereotypes and assumptions.
As Indigenous people, we're taught to give thanks every day. And we do, but we're not going to give thanks for the invasion of Native homelands and the theft of our land and the oppression of our people.
She says the General Assembly is considering five pieces of legislation that address Indigenous concerns. One bill would create and implement Native curricula in schools, as there currently is nothing about contemporary Indigenous cultures. Others would ban the use of Native mascots in schools, create Indigenous Peoples Day statewide, protect sacred Native American heritage items, and improve educational outcomes for Native students. This is Lily Bolke for Commonwealth News Service.
Elsewhere in California, Indigenous activists have gathered on Alcatraz Island, which Red Power activists occupied from 1969 to 1971. Incidentally, the occupiers created Radio Free Alcatraz, which broadcasts on Pacifica Network stations like KABU. With more on today's activities, it's Suzanne Potter.
Some 400 years ago, in 1621, the settlers and Native tribes ate together at the first Thanksgiving meal. But now, many tribes see this seminal date in American history as a day to mourn the losses of Native American lives and land that followed. This Thursday, 5,000 to 6,000 people are expected to attend the annual sunrise gathering on Alcatraz to honor the 19-month occupation of the island by Native American activists from 1969 to 1971. Morningstar Galley with the International Indian Treaty Council is coordinating the event.
We celebrate this day as a day of healing, as a day of truth-telling. It's a day of resistance to the exploitation that Indigenous peoples are continuing to fight.
The IITC is also promoting a campaign, Gold, Greed, and Genocide, that draws attention to the legacy of the gold rush. Miners moving west brought diseases that devastated the Native population. And Galley says, to heal, California must come to terms with all aspects of its history. She notes, at one time, the state actually targeted Native Americans for extinction, paying out $1 million for scalping expeditions in 1851.
There was this onslaught of bounty hunters that were chasing through our people and massacring our villages. We were force marched off of our land between the 1830s and 1860s. And so California Indian leaders were imprisoned on Alcatraz Island.
Native American advocates have also campaigned for the removal of statues of Father Junipero Serra in cities up and down the California coast. They argue that the mission system Serra oversaw enslaved, relocated, or killed hundreds of thousands of indigenous Californians. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Several tribes from the southeast are petitioning the University of Alabama to return artifacts and human remains belonging to their ancestors. With that story and more, it's Mark Hughes with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Art Hughes, in for Antonia Gonzalez. A federal panel says human remains and other artifacts held by the University of Alabama are connected to seven tribes working to get the items returned. Newsweek reports the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Review Committee concluded there is a preponderance of evidence for cultural affiliation between the tribes and the items stored at the Moundville Archaeological Park. The Muscogee Creek Nation, the Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma, and five other tribes filed a petition under NAGPRA to have the items returned. Muscogee Principal Chief David Hill issued a statement saying the excuses for delay are over and there is no reason to wait any longer to return the nation's ancestors. The university estimates there are almost 6,000 human remains and funerary artifacts taken from a former settlement in Alabama. While the committee can issue findings, it can't unilaterally require the university to return the items. The Cherokee Nation is among those urging its citizens to follow health and safety precautions from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention during the upcoming holidays. Cherokee Nation Public Health Medical Director David Gahn told the Examiner Enterprise that COVID-19 vaccinations are the best way to ensure a safe holiday gathering. He says those not fully vaccinated should wear a well-fitting mask. He says people who are especially vulnerable or those visiting high transmission areas should wear a mask whether they are vaccinated or not. Another Oklahoma tribe is requiring all workers to receive the COVID vaccine, saying unvaccinated employees are a hazard to the tribe, other employees, and guests. Citizen Potawatomi Nation Chairman John Rocky Barrett issued a public statement saying the tribe no longer chooses to allow unvaccinated employees to touch and breathe on their children in the daycare and serve food to their elders. The city of Boston, a band of the Massachusetts tribe, are working together to protect an area used as a toolmaking quarry dating back 7,500 years. WBUR reports the Mattapan Rhyolite Quarry has remained relatively undisturbed, surrounded by urban development. This month, the city's Landmarks Commission voted to start the process for designating the site a cultural landmark. The city and the Massachusetts tribe issued a joint petition to protect the site as a unique cultural asset. The city archaeologist told the commission that it is significant because of the unique stone material was prized by Native Americans for making tools. Ancestors set up a village near the quarry and defended it against enemies wanting to use it for their own tools. If the designation goes through, the tribe will maintain the site and educate others about it. National voter registration forms are now translated into three indigenous languages. The U.S. Election Assistance Commission says it's the first time the form has expanded to include native languages. In addition to written Navajo and Yupik translations, the form will have an audio-only translation for Apache speakers. The voter registration form is now available in 21 languages, including English. This week, we are recognizing the new inductees in the Native American Hall of Fame. Among the eight people honored at a ceremony this month is Muskogee poet and musician Joy Harjo. She is the Poet Laureate of the United States. In an interview after the ceremony, Harjo said her success all comes down to family.
All of those who taught me, my Aunt Lois, who I was close to, and my ceremonial grounds. What was passed on to me by especially my father and his family, was a love for the people. And that's what has gotten me here, I think, in the first place. Of course, I'm a little disciplined, too, but, you know. But really, that is what has fed this journey.
That is Joy Harjo, who was inducted into the Native American Hall of Fame earlier this month, along with seven other people. That interview was recorded by Andy Murphy. With National Native News, I'm Art Hughes.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, November 24th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael and Stevie Ray. The producer is myself, Ethan Sandweiss, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Dan Raphael, Stevie Ray, Mary Sherman, Mark Hughes, Suzanne Potter, and Lily Bolke. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Ethan Sandweiss. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support your local community radio station, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for The Importance of Sustainable Fisheries with Stevie Ray.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Having just written an op-ed with the Shellfish Growers Climate Coalition about the Build Back Better Act and the difficulties he has faced as a result of climate change, such as the greater risk of foodborne illnesses to melting infrastructure.
So would you mind introducing yourself?
Yeah, hi, my name is Leif Gildersleeve from Flying Fish Company.
You wrote an opinion piece recently called Our Oceans Can't Wait for Climate Action, where you discuss the bloom of Vibrio bacteria in the Pacific Ocean. What is that, and how did it happen?
This summer, when we had the heat dome, we had, an outbreak of some bad bacteria. So, like, on the East Coast or other places, where sometimes they'll call it red tide. There's different types of bad algae or bacteria that can bloom based on different circumstances. And with what happened this summer with that extra heat, it created an environment where that bad stuff grew and bloomed in the ocean, which then got into the shellfish and then got into humans and negatively impacted us in our bellies, basically. So it gives you an upset stomach and often doesn't lead to more serious things unless there's other adverse background stuff that's going on with the person that's getting infected. But it can make you sick when you eat the shellfish that has Vibrio in it. So unfortunately that happened. And, you know, it's a sign of our times, of how our human impact on this earth is affecting not only ourselves directly back directly through the circle of the earth, but you know, it's time that we wake up and realize that our actions as humans are really affecting lots of organisms on this planet, and we just be more mindful about how we treat the planet and find ways that we can limit our impact. My family had a fish market growing up since before I was born, actually. So throughout my childhood, I was helping out in the family fish market and that. So I've been around the seafood industry for my whole life. So a lot of things have changed and continue to change due to climate change. So right now we're seeing just unprecedented worldly things from the environment, whether it be, you know, currents are changing, which are creating environments in the ocean, like dead zones where you get no oxygen because of too many organisms that are blooming, and it eats up, depletes all the oxygen, and that creates, you know, death when it comes to fish and other organisms that need that oxygen, along with, you know, runoff and contaminants and loss of habitat, you know, inland, and then the dam. So no doubt we're seeing things, you know, add up to make it really hard for the earth to provide, you know, everything that it's provided already with, you know, organisms and ones that we're able to harvest for our own.